From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette. You're listening to Idaho Matters. As we approach the fourth anniversary of the emergence of COVID-19 and the fourth anniversary of our doctor roundtable right here on Idaho Matters, it's time for a look back at the year that was in public health. And a busy year in public health it was, with the official end of the COVID-19 public health emergency, but the emergence of some new nasty strains of the coronavirus. Plus, we saw new diseases make their way around the world, including monkeypox, malaria, measles, even polio. There were new vaccines for everything from COVID to RSV, and we saw shortages of some critical drugs, from Adderall to life-saving cancer medications. So here for our Doctor Roundtable Year in Review is Dr. David Pate, who has been with us faithfully for almost 4 years now. So aside from being our guide through the public health quicksand, he is also the former CEO of St. Luke's Health System. Dr. Pate, it is always a pleasure to have you on the program.
Oh, thank you, Gemma.
Okay, first off, can you believe it's been 4 years since we started hearing about COVID-19? I mean, we're talking officially in the GEM state in March of 2020, but it did start to move out of China in late 2019. Did you imagine 4 years ago, Dr. Pate, that we would be in the place we are now?
No idea. Of course, anybody that knows me will tell you I'm very naive. But, you know, I think back when this happened, I had just retired. I had so many plans of things I was going to be doing and had no idea this is what I would be spending my time on. And, you know, as part of that naivete, even when I learned about this threat, I really thought we would all rally and contain the spread of the disease and maybe even eliminate it like happened with the first SARS coronavirus back in 2003. But boy, what a difference 2 decades makes.
Oh, no kidding. Okay, so let's look back at 2023 and let's start with January. This is when we were still looking at a triple-demic of COVID, RSV, and the flu, but there was also a growing outbreak of strep throat, and then we saw a shortage of over-the-counter children's Tylenol, not just in Idaho, but nationwide, Dr. Pate. And I know this was something that you had so many parents reaching out to you about.
Oh, yeah. Big problems. You know, so many things here. You know, no doubt that the change in the public's willingness to embrace interventions like we had, especially in 2020 and still somewhat in 2021, where we really suppressed the levels of those winter respiratory viruses. When people stopped taking those precautions, it's in part no surprise that those infections would reemerge and big time. But it is interesting. We've learned more, and now we do see potential connections between the SARS-CoV-2 infection and changes that occur in your nasal and oral passages that could explain why people are more susceptible to strep. And remember, Gemma, it wasn't just that we were seeing more cases of the so-called strep throat. We were seeing many more cases of really invasive strep, which is serious and lands people in the hospitals and can even kill them. Also, we have just recently learned that prior COVID in young children actually predisposed them to RSV infection. So it wasn't surprising that in 22, when we saw huge numbers of infections in young children, that that would be followed by a surge in RSV, which we would see normally anyway, but we saw much more last year. And, you know, I think that given all of these surges of respiratory infections, when in previous years they'd been much less, I think it caught the pharmaceutical manufacturers a bit off guard. And so for some of these drugs, it was just a matter they didn't produce enough because they weren't anticipating the demand.
And it was just, I remember it just being so frustrating for parents, you know, when you couldn't go into the grocery store and just find simple children's Tylenol.
Oh, yeah. Very terrible. And, you know, of course, this is a larger issue that we really need to address in the United States about supplies of pharmaceutical drugs, as well as other medical supplies. And also, I think we really need pharmacies to engage in being able to put out information about what they have, what they don't have on websites or something. You remember driving around to a lot of pharmacies. I know my daughter, who has four mm-hmm. young boys, was driving around looking at places, and it shouldn't be that difficult.
So let's go to February, since that was everything that happened in January. Levels of COVID in Boise's wastewater was up. So this marked a new way to track the disease. And then the Idaho legislature was considering a bill to make it a misdemeanor to give a shot of the mRNA COVID-19 vaccine. Dr. Pate, what were your thoughts when this was going on?
Well, I don't think I can say verbatim my thoughts, or Samantha's going to hit the bleep button, but, you know, I think this whole business about making it a misdemeanor to give the mRNA COVID-19 vaccine, you know, is another example, again, of my naivete. I really think the Idaho legislature still surprised me that they would spend time on that kind of nonsense when there were so many other things about the pandemic that they didn't discuss at all. So, you know, issues like, what are we going to do about supply chain issues in Idaho? Do we need our own strategic stockpile? Or what steps are we going to make sure for the next crisis that we have the supplies we need? The other thing is that I kept on pointing out, but got no one's interest at all, is that what if the next pandemic did the reverse? And this is quite possible, especially if we think about influenza viruses, where instead of it being so much adults that were in and up in the hospital, that it was really making children deathly ill. Mm-hmm. I can tell you, we are not prepared for that in so many different ways. But there was no discussion on the legislature's part about, well, what would we do to create temporary expansion of hospital bed capacity and things like that. So I just think that spending time coming up with more ways to threaten Idaho healthcare workforce with potential crimes, such as administering a vaccine, is really not what we want. And in fact, we're seeing the consequences of all of this anti-healthcare worker sentiment, that we're just creating more shortages. And pretty soon, Idahoans are going to feel that and be upset. Let me mention on the wastewater testing, you know, the good news. Wastewater testing isn't new, but that is one of the good things that you just mentioned that came out of this pandemic. And it's what we did is we learned how to use wastewater testing more effectively and for more purposes. So not only did it help us monitor disease activity once testing shifted from commercial labs that had to report to the state to home testing where it was not reported, but also it was able to give us information about what variants we were dealing with here locally, which was very helpful. And then most recently, researchers at Boise State University just published a study that they could actually use the wastewater testing to be predictive of upcoming hospitalizations and deaths, to help give hospitals, you know, a couple weeks or several weeks notice of what's coming their way. So it was very, very helpful. And we did learn a lot about that.
So let's head to March of 2023. This is when the director of the FBI said the Bureau believed that COVID-19 most likely originated in a Chinese government-controlled lab and that there was a leak. And that's what caused the virus to spread. So Dr. Pate, remind us of this.
Yeah, you know, at the time, it didn't make any difference to me whether this came out of a lab or it came from animals in terms of how we were responding to this. So, I mean, I didn't have a dog in that fight, and I didn't really, wasn't trying to make it come out one way or the other. But that's not to say this question doesn't make a big difference in the big picture. First, and again, here comes my naivete showing, I had assumed that all of our intelligence agencies shared intelligence and talked to each other. Yet what we saw when the president told them to come forth with their assessments is it was like 6 or 8 different agencies, and most of them came to the same conclusion, but some, like the FBI that you just mentioned, came out with a completely different assessment. And one has to wonder, are they talking to each other? Are they sharing intelligence and sources? And whether you think that's critical or not for this, we just saw an example overseas when there's an intelligence failure. So I hope someone in our federal government will address that. Second, if it is a lab leak, then obviously we need the world scientific community to come together and investigate what was that failure and make sure we agree across the world in these laboratories to adopt standards that would decrease the risk of that in the future. Now, having reviewed the evidence to date, I am greatly persuaded that this came from an animal spillover infection into humans at the markets. And this would not be the first time. It happened with the first SARS-CoV virus. And so I think that what we need to be doing, instead of making all kinds of accusations that really, you know, we have to consider the Chinese government and Chinese scientists, their culture is they're going to be highly, highly offended by these accusations. They take a lot of pride in what they do and their research. And obviously, if it was an issue, we had to deal with it. But making these accusations is not going to make the country more willing to work with us. And what we need to do is come together, because these animal markets are going to pose ongoing threats. And we're not going to be able to get them talked into not having them, but it's time to get countries that have these animal markets to come together and agree to infection control measures that would make these kinds of spillover events less likely, or we're going to deal with it again.
Okay, Dr. Payne, let's jump into April. So just as a new COVID variant started making the rounds, hospitals and health clinics here in Idaho and elsewhere started dropping their mask requirements as mask fatigue became widespread. And then there was a new COVID booster that was about to be approved. And I'm not sure if I'm going to say this right, but hemorrhagic fever was spreading out of Tanzania. Shingles was also a topic of conversation. And then there was a shortage of drugs, in particular to treat ADHD like Adderall. And that was becoming a growing problem. So a lot going on in April. So you tell me where you want to begin with all this. Yeah.
Oh, my. So much. Well, you know, I have to say that there are so many things that I have been proud of St. Alphonsus and St. Luke's for what they did during the pandemic. Very, very, very proud. However, again, here comes that naivety. I was shocked by their decisions and how they implemented their changes relating to the mask policies. And that doesn't mean that I'm insensitive to the challenges that they were facing. I certainly was aware of the challenges, but I have to say the public announcements of these decisions that they made, these were just among the worst communications I've ever seen. I just think you can make a decision like this, but you still need to acknowledge the fears of people that you serve. Who goes to hospitals? People that have a lot of medical conditions, and people that are older or very, very young. And these are all the people that are at highest risk, not to mention people that are immunocompromised. So I was dealing with a lot of people afraid to go to the hospitals. That's not what we want. So I think it would have been a lot more, it would have been a lot better if they would just acknowledge some of this and address some of those fears. And it would demonstrate empathy, something that it has been all too short during this pandemic. I also think there were better ways to implement it and to be able to address the patient's fears. And I also think that the transparency about, okay, well, if you're taking the masks away, what else are you doing to help protect patients? And I've certainly encouraged that the hospitals be more transparent about this. What are they doing? What are the results of these changes to policy, et cetera? And unfortunately, it's woefully lacking. You also mentioned about the COVID booster. You know, that's a different story. Here, it's actually mind-boggling the advances that we've made in vaccinology in just these past 3 to 4 years. It's really astounding. And in fact, it in part explains why you were mentioning the progress we've made with some of these other diseases. We now have vaccine candidates for malaria, chikungunya, and a number of other diseases that have evaded us until now that we couldn't find good vaccines for. On the other hand, the anti-vax campaigns have gained steam, and they've really made significant inroads over these past few years. And unfortunately, we're seeing the consequences of that already in some of the disease outbreaks that you and I have discussed this year.
Mm-hmm. So, Dr. Pate, let's quickly go back to about the shortage in certain drugs. And because, yes, it impacted folks with ADHD quite a bit, in particular with things like Adderall. Why were we seeing this shortage? And frankly, the fact that, I mean, let's fast forward to today. I mean, it's gotten better, but this supply chain issue is not fixed.
No. And I don't think people appreciate how much more threat this could be. While you've mentioned a number of medications already, like the over-the-counter Tylenol, the Adderall for ADHD, certainly we've seen some antibiotic shortages, but we also had shortages of critical drugs that we use in the hospital. And that got less publicity, but it was a really big problem. So, you know, the reasons are multifactorial, but let's consider this fact. If you look to many of the drugs that are prescribed here in the United States, and you look at vaccines, most of the ingredients, or in the case of medication, sometimes the entire medication, they come overwhelmingly from two countries, China and India. Now, consider that I've already mentioned two times, and there's more, where pandemics have arisen in China. And consider that China's response this time, I don't know if it will be next time, was that complete lockdown. Well, what's going to happen to the manufacturing plants in China if there's a lockdown or if people are sick and can't go to work? We're going to feel these shortages. India was also hit very significantly, and that could disrupt things that we need, particularly on the vaccine fronts. So that's an issue. The other issue is when you think about a pandemic, what makes a pandemic? A pandemic is worldwide increase in these infections. Well, that's going to cause worldwide demand for these things. And so we have to have better ways to ramp up production, more capacity. And that's not going to be a financial incentive for most companies to have that capacity when it's not used absent a pandemic. So we have to figure out new incentives or new ways to do that. Those are just some of the issues. It's really far more complex, and we're going to have to give this a lot of thought. There needs to be work by our federal and state governments on this.
Mm. So let's go to May. This is when the United States ended the official COVID-19 public health emergency, just in time for a new wave of infections to hit China. We're talking infecting as many as 65 million people a week. Now, the end of the emergency meant that COVID test results no longer had to be reported to the CDC. We also saw ringworm and monkeypox spreading, and there was word that some mutations of Mpox might be drug resistant. So, Dr. Pate, let's talk about the ending of the public health emergency.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the problems was that people equated the ending of the public health emergency with the ending of the pandemic, and those were not the same. And so I think one of the things that really hurt us is people thought, oh, okay, so it's not that much of a problem. But also with the ending of the public health emergency declaration, that also resulted in what we would experience later with vaccines now moving to the commercial market, not being provided by the government. A lot of these drugs that people didn't have to pay for now going to the commercial markets, and even the availability of testing. Now people are going to have to, in many cases, pay for their tests rather than having those covered. So lots of consequences of that.
And then we go into June. A public health warning came out after the United States saw 5 cases of mosquito spread malaria. And there was also a new study showing that getting COVID could lead to the onset of hypertension, which is better known as high blood pressure. This was, Dr. Pate, just one of a host of long-term side effects that we are now seeing 4 years into this.
You are absolutely right. You know, it's just one of many things, the new onset hypertension. One of the concerns about it is hypertension is not something that most people are aware of until it causes a problem, because you typically don't have symptoms with that. So, and as you mentioned, it's just one of many things that can be a long-term consequence. A couple problems. One is all of the discussion around COVID tends to center on people dying. And yet what you and I have discussed for the past 4 years is dying is not the only thing you have to worry about. We have to worry about these long-term consequences of infection, and that's not getting enough airtime. So I commend you and Idaho Matters for taking this up and making sure people are aware. Second thing is that the point is rarely made that if you or your child has had COVID, you should not wait for the next routine checkup that would otherwise be recommended. You need to get evaluated within months after your recovery from the COVID so that we can do assessments and determine if you're having any of these long-term consequences. So you're going to need to see the doctor more often. And then I would just go back to your other point about malaria. My goodness, you know, that's another disease that we once eliminated from the United States. We eliminated it back in 1951. And until this year, the only times I ever saw malaria cases and any of the other doctors in the U.S., it was international travelers. And now we've had 2 forms of malaria pop up in at least 3 different states. And there are other diseases before malaria. There were other diseases that we typically didn't see here that only occurred in the Southern Hemisphere, but Zika, people may remember that occurred in Florida and caused severely deformed babies, and chikungunya, which we had not seen here before. We had an outbreak of that. So we really have to ramp up our public health awareness and public health responses, because we're seeing new diseases emerge in the United States and we're seeing others return.
So we're to July of 2023 right now, Dr. Pate, and this is when we saw the White House replacing the COVID-19 Pandemic Response Office with a permanent Office of Pandemic Preparedness and Response. Now, this is to prepare and to respond to biological threats and pathogens that can lead to pandemics. Now, the U.S. also saw outbreaks of dengue fever, monkeypox, measles, malaria, polio. The FDA approved a new drug for babies and toddlers at the same time. This was to fight RSV. And then they also came out with new guidelines for breast cancer screening. So let's begin July with this Office of Pandemic Preparedness and Response, and it being a permanent office.
Yeah, I saw this as one of the very positive steps that the government has taken. As we've talked about many times, we have to be mindful that this won't be the last pandemic. And I actually believe we're less prepared now than we were 4 years ago. And it should be the other way around. And I think we have to keep in mind that as dreadful as COVID was, there are so many respects that we actually got off easy. There's no guarantee that the next pandemic will cause milder illness in children, as we just talked about. And we're not prepared as a country for that. And there's no guarantee that we will be able to develop a new vaccine for whatever is causing the next pandemic in less than a year, like we did for this one. And there's plenty of viruses that can cause far higher mortality rates than the SARS-CoV-2 virus. So I am concerned that people have kind of gotten numb about the, you know, this issue of pandemics. I think there are people mm-hmm. that think, well, pandemics occur like every 100 years, so I'm not going to see another one. And actually, if you go back and look, they actually occur almost every 10 years. But it's just that they, in the past, we've put them out quicker or done the actions we need to. So I hope this gets more attention. I bet it won't.
So in August, COVID infections and hospitalizations were once again on the rise, not just here in the U.S., but also in Europe and in Asia. And this was due in part to this new EG5 Omicron subvariant. And the World Health Organization announced a new priority disease. This is the deadly Crimean Congo, Dr. Payne, I don't know if I'm saying this right, hemorrhagic fever.
Hemorrhagic, you got it.
Thank you so much. And then we also saw a shortage of more than 150 drugs, including some life-saving cancer medications. So Dr. Payne, did that go back to what we talked about in the last segment when we were seeing shortages of ADHD medications?
Absolutely. You know, there was a variation of reasons that we've dealt with shortages, but it's all part of the same themes. We have to have more redundancy. We have to have more ability to ramp up. In some cases, there's only one manufacturer making a drug. And so if something happens to them, you remember earlier in the year, we saw damage to a pharmaceutical manufacturing plant in, I think it was Kansas, by tornadoes. So we could have weather events. We had with some of these medications, like you and I talked about eye drops, we had a problem with quality control. And these eye drops are made in other countries, which makes it very hard for us to give the same degree of supervision and oversight. So lots of different specific reasons for each of these drugs, but we've got to have a better plan and more focus on this and more preparation for the future.
And Dr. Payne, talk to us about these infections being on the rise in August. I mean, I remember this as well. And is this something that, I mean, we just are all going to have to at this point just get used to and live with, that sometimes we're going to see these new variants and we're going to see more infections?
Well, there's no end in sight, that's for sure. You know, this is the first time that we've had a pandemic driven by recombinant viruses, EG5 being an example. Remember, a recombinant virus happens when two viruses, similar viruses, are infecting someone. Most often, we think this occurs in immunocompromised people, and these two viruses then swap some of their genetic materials so that you get a new type of virus that comes as a result. And this started, every time we mentioned a new variant that started with the letter X, those are recombinants. Now we have so many of them, we've stopped using the X, and so some of these are like EG5, but they're all recombinants right now. And frankly, the modeling that's been done shows that the viruses have many, many more potential opportunities to do this. So I don't know whether we're going to deal with this for the rest of our lives, but that's certainly a potential. What I'm hopeful is that there would be progress in some of the nasal vaccines. And while I was skeptical in the past, I'm seeing some really promising data. I am hopeful that there might be better uptake of a nasal vaccine, first of all, for those that are afraid of needles, but maybe with so much disinformation out there, maybe people would be less concerned about nasal vaccines. So it's possible we could come up with ways to confront it. But certainly, if one looks at the situation today, not a lot of optimism there.
So then in September, the FDA put a halt on a new drug. It was actually supposed to replace the EpiPen, which treats anaphylactic shock. And then we had the deadly Nipah virus spreading in India. And then in October, Dr. Pate, you and I looked at the reemergence of polio in advance of World Polio Day. And I have to say, I'm still stunned by the fact that we are seeing polio cases.
Yeah, it's it is quite shocking. And it is part of our ability to minimize threats. When you talked, so I was born, because I'm old, not you, but I was born at a time when polio was a huge worry of parents. I've talked to my parents, and they've discussed about how scary it was that they would go to the movies and there'd be commercials at the beginning of the movies that showed people in the iron lungs. And of course, back then, everybody knew somebody that had had polio, might have died from polio, might have been hospitalized with polio, or might be limping around with a brace for one of their legs, that kind of thing. So, you know, then it was a really big concern. And when the vaccine came out, it's not like today where people are thinking, oh, my gosh, we don't want to get a vaccine. They lined up. My mom said, you know, people were lined up outside of the building to get the vaccine because they were so worried about their children. So it is concerning. And of course, now with the anti-vaccine mantra, and you look at a state like Idaho that you know, Kevin Reichert has done some amazing reporting on this, where we have so many exemptions for vaccines that now perhaps up to 20% of children entering into public school don't have all these vaccines. And so we're going to see resurgences, particularly of some of these diseases that are so terribly contagious. And so we've seen measles outbreaks in Ohio. We had a measles outbreak in Canyon County, you might remember, that we talked about. And then, you know, we fear rubella coming back. And this is a real problem for pregnant moms and congenital abnormalities or even stillbirths of pregnancies. Mumps that could result in boys becoming sterilized. All kinds of diseases. And now we've got this case of polio in New York, which is totally preventable. But this young man was not vaccinated. And unfortunately, he's paying the price. He is now paralyzed for the rest of his life. It is a terrible tragedy.
So in September and October, the FDA approved a new COVID vaccine, which is designed to protect better against new variants of the virus. So distribution was at first tricky, Dr. Pate, and the drug ran into some high demand, as well as insurance headaches and then supply delays all around the country. We should say it's gotten easier. So when the New York Times reported in October that only 7% of adults had gotten the shot, that was concerning among a lot of health officials. Now, apparently, only 1 in 5 people, 75 and older, have gotten that new shot, despite more than 1,000 people dying of COVID every single week here in the United States. So Dr. Pate, is there vaccine fatigue, or is it that, you know, out of mind for people? I mean, why do you think people are not getting this latest shot?
Yeah, I have to tell you, I was very shocked at the low uptake, especially in the elderly. It's, you know, I think there's this common refrain that the pandemic is over. And yet, if things continue at the present rate, if you look at how many people are dying today, if that continues, that means we will have 75,000 people, Americans, dying every year. And so I think people are not aware that there is this much disease still going on. And of course, other than your show, this isn't covered hardly at all in the media, in the press. And so people would think, well, it must be over. It's no big deal. I think it's less vaccine fatigue because generally, especially in the elderly group, if you tell them that this is necessary and they do it, they tend to be the highest uptake group. I think this is part not making them aware of what the real situation is. Two, vaccine disinformation, scaring people. I still am talking to people that are saying things that are just totally untrue about the vaccines, and we have the data now. I think it's also part of a broader anti-science, anti-vaccine movement in the U.S., which is very concerning because, first of all, it's very well financed. And then second, as we've seen in the age of social media, there's a number of healthcare providers who would have some credibility who are perpetuating this disinformation, and I'm not clear about their motivations for doing so, but they're having significant reach. I think the other thing is that people are not aware of what waning immunity means, not understanding what the risks of not getting vaccinated are. And of course, my fear is, Jim, as we'll be talking on your show in the upcoming days and weeks, is we are coming up to Thanksgiving, and then we're coming up to the end of the year holidays. There's going to be lots of family gatherings with very young children and elderly adults, and I think we have the recipe for disaster.
So, Dr. Pate, do you think that we will need to keep getting COVID boosters?
I do think so. I think we long ago missed our opportunity to eliminate this disease, like happened with the first SARS-CoV virus. And I think today there's just too many immunocompromised people that are infected and they don't clear the infection, at least they don't potentially for years. And so they continue to pose a risk that even some of the variants that we think are gone could reemerge in a new recombination as these individuals get infected further, because we're just not doing, we haven't done anything hardly to protect the immunocompromised people. And I think you and I have talked about the huge numbers of animals that are infected, and we are learning that in some of those cases, those animals that humans infected now can infect us back. So I don't think COVID is going away. What I am bullish about, as I mentioned a little bit ago, is the potential that we could get better and more durable vaccines. And I mentioned about the nasal vaccines I'm excited about, but there's a lot of research going into how we can come up with even better vaccines. So we might not have to give them quite so often, but for the foreseeable future, my guess is high-risk people are going to probably need two shots a year, and everybody else probably the annual vaccine. But, you know, things could change in a couple of years.
Well, and we still have the same issue as how, even though you have the boosters available, you got to have, you have to have people get them. And that's
amen. Well, amen. Yeah. And, you know, the vaccine does no good until it becomes a vaccination.
So, Dr. Pate, I want to go. I want to go all the way back to April as we wrap up our time with you, because you wrote a book with Dr. Ted Epperle. It came out in April of this year, called "Preparing for the Next Global Outbreak," and in it, you say that it is not a matter of if, but when the next disease outbreak hits. You've already talked about it in this program today. You have talked about it in the past, right here on Idaho Matters. So, what is the future for COVID as well as public health, and what can just regular people do to not just prepare, but to maybe try to keep it, you know, not top of mind, but not, you know, anxiety inducing?
Well, the most important thing you can do is to give everyone on your Christmas list a copy of the book. I'm just guessing.
Good idea.
So in seriousness, you know, the purpose of the book is, number one, to make sure that we documented the lessons of this pandemic and came up with ideas for how we could respond differently to the next one. As you and I were talking before the show, you know, we tend to forget so much. I remember some people just reading the first chapter of my book and saying, oh my gosh, I'd completely forgotten about that. So one is we need to be reminded. The second thing is that we need to not take this for granted. As I mentioned earlier, pandemics are not 100-year events. They're probably decade events. And there's so much we can do to prepare. We need to get together and think about, okay, what are the things that aren't going to create ideological division and drama that we could talk about, like supply chain? Who's going to get outraged about that? Like building capacity? Like how would we respond to a new threat that we don't have a vaccine for? Those kinds of things. I think the other thing is that, and, you know, and this is where people like you, Gemma, and I know you have the journalist roundtable. This is a place where you guys can help. One of the things you guys have to do is you always have to evaluate sources of information, because you don't want to be spreading misinformation. And you all have learned, how do you determine whether a person source is qualified or a news source is reliable? And we need to start teaching that to the public and teaching it to kids in school. I'm all for people making their own decisions about what actions they want to take to protect themselves or not. But what I'm not up for is people being misled and people making a decision that they otherwise wouldn't have made if they only had correct information. So we have to teach people how to evaluate these sources so that at least you can make an informed decision when the next pandemic occurs.
Well, Dr. Pate, there aren't enough words to thank you enough for all that you have done over these past 4 years. You have guided us through COVID. You are now guiding us through other public health issues that are popping up. So we might add, without any compensation, once in a while, we might send you a pair of socks. So, but in all honesty, thank you for your wisdom and your information. And we look forward to continuing this with you.
Well, you're so kind. Thank you. I'm glad if this helps even a few people. And I know it does.
Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
Did you know you are physically adapting to all your swiping, scrolling, and tapping?
We're changing our bodies and what they're able to do through our habits.
NPR's Body Electric, a special interactive series investigating how to fix the relationship between our tech and our health. Listen in the TED Radio Hour feed wherever you get your podcasts.